Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Wednesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXE Acra 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Usually at this point, we would introduce our guest. However, given that today marks the end of our second year, we want to take the opportunity to reflect back on some of the best moments from our guests from 2015.
You are about to hear excerpts from our shows with Tom Antonov, Christian Griffin, Sean Doolin, Ronnie Claypool, Melinda Pokola, Brian Spinner, Thomas Reed, James Pintotti, Larry Gambin, and Unc Slater. These are some of our favorite moments, and we hope you enjoy listening to them as much as we do.
So, Melinda, tell me a bit about this horror film movie buff thing you've got going on here.
I'm so sick of that. It's really ridiculous. I love horror films. I've loved horror films since I was a kid. And I think the film, and this is still my favorite horror movie till this day, but I think the film that kind of started this obsession was Scream. Uh-huh. So this is actually my mom, who's extremely hilarious, took me and a friend, I can't remember what friend, to see Scream in theaters. And if you guys remember, in the first half of Scream, like the first 20 minutes of Scream is probably...
I've never seen it.
What?
Never seen Scream.
That's not allowed.
I've never seen it either.
What?
No? Yeah.
Wow, really? With Nev Campbell and Skeet Ulrich?
That's a Scream, Mike.
Yeah, he actually says that in the movie.
Yeah? Yeah,
he's like, that's a Scream, baby. It's really hilarious. But my mom took us to the theater, and in the first 20 minutes, it's hilarious. Because it was a rated R movie, so we were 12, so it's like you need a parental advisory to get in there. And first 20 minutes, my mom got up and left. She's like, well, I'm going to go shopping in the mall. Have fun. I was like super scared. But ever since then,
was it scary?
Here's the thing. It's like, it was, actually, I don't think Scream was overtly scary to me. I can tell you about the movie that first, Scream was more or less super fun for me. Because it's a slasher flick. It's like that, you know, Wes Craven kind of, and it's written in the way that it's funny. Like, there's a lot of jokes in it.
Right.
It's not funny to see people get killed on screen, but, like, the jokes are pretty hilarious.
The kind of irony, the dry humor, the black humor.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right. That very dark humor.
The classic, like, they're in the house alone, and what better thing to do than go up into the attic by yourself to see what that scary noise was.
Absolutely.
Of course this is rational.
Yeah, I heard a noise there. Yeah. Let's go up with no defense mechanism whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was actually the interesting thing about Scream is they make fun of that throughout the movie. So it's kind of like satirical.
Parody.
Yeah, it's kind of a critical in a sense, yeah. But even, I think the thing I like most about horror is like that frighten, like that's, you know, the fear you get is almost like an adrenaline rush.
Mm.
So it's like very similar.
So you're attracted to that adrenaline rush.
Indeed. But I think if there's a movie that genuinely scared me, like scared the life out of me, the first horror movie I saw that scared the life out of me was Fire in the Sky. Came out in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah. With aliens.
With the aliens.
Yeah. Well,
have you seen that, Mike?
I have. Indeed. Yeah. Oh. I'm all about aliens and have been ever since I was a kid.
Oh, my gosh, me too.
Yeah. I had read that story as a kid in some book in the school library or something. And then when I heard they were making a movie out of it, I was like, oh, my gosh, I read that. And it was pretty scary.
So now, am I right in saying that you dress up in scary costumes and all that?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. I actually just had my 30th birthday, and I actually made all of my friends and family dress up as characters from horror movies. Like, I provided food, so it's fine, and I provided music and dance and booze and whatever, but the whole theme of the party was like kind of like a horror house, right. Haunted house kind of theme. And I had some very good friends lend me some props, and then I bought some props, and at first I think my family might have thought I was a little... off my rocker. Like, my grandfather even came to this party, which was hilarious.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was cool. And the whole time I had horror movies projecting on the wall.
Awesome.
And my grandfather's over there was like, what is this crap?
I mean, if you think about it, a bridge is like a metaphor for life, isn't it?
Yeah. I built one.
You built one, you know what I mean?
And I almost died building one, too, when I was a water well driller, actually.
Well, tell us, give it, do tell.
Yeah, sure. So, along with doing the simple, you know, 6 to 8 inch water well.
Like, he's doing that as if we're, we're regular water drillers. Well, we know what he's talking about.
6 or 8 inch.
And we're on radio, and he's, like, doing that with his hands. So.
Basically, the tube, the straw, the steel tube that goes into the ground will be 6 to 8 inches, depending on the... I mean, it'll vary for the amount of water that the pump and facility will need. This was not a well, though. This was a bridge pylon, the center support that is supposed to be on bedrock.
Right. Yes.
What had happened was the...
the town where the Flintstones live.
Sure.
Bedrock. Right. Yeah. And is this in the river? So you're having to drill a hole under
this
that's
is
underwater?
On the banks of like a creek.
Banks. Okay. Gotcha.
And so a lot of the ground in Alaska has permafrost in it. Yeah. So just frozen ice under
tundra.
Basically, yeah. So that's why a lot of roads in Alaska are very lumpy. This particular spot on the bridge, they were a little short on their measurements. So while we were clearing out the pylon, they actually had to stop us and bring the steel. This was big 18-inch steel for this pylon. So they had to actually put it down deeper and dig out a hole for the so they could drop it lower. And then the EPA said we had to use a special foaming agent to build pressure to get all the debris out. They said they can run off into the river, even though it was EPA approved, this and that. Okay, so what's happening is we're clearing it out, and the big truck starts tipping over.
Oh, no!
And these big geysers shoot up of all of our foaming agent next to our truck, and it's just like, we're already up to our shins in foam around the truck, and it's just like, oh, man, we gotta go.
Gotta get out of here.
Yeah, and so my job was to break all these 4-inch air hoses, and you have to use a sledgehammer to break them. So I was going to, on the back of the truck, there's two platforms on either side. One side is the drill guy running the hydraulics, and the other side has my tools. I was walking to my side of the truck to get onto the platform, and I just drop.
Wow.
Like I've, slipped, or?
No, I fall, I go under the surface of this foam.
Wow.
And I'm gone. Oh. I've disappeared.
Like in a kabloop? Foam party?
Into a pool of foam.
Like a sinkhole.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, and between the two platforms is the drill steel going down into the pylon. We're already about 25 feet in, and we're working on, you know, going... We got to get to about 55, 60 feet.
Can I ask... Sorry to interrupt you.
Go for it.
Did you feel like this is it?
Yeah. Yeah, right, I was in there, and I was panicking. I was freaking out, jumping, trying to, like... And all I could hear was the motors of the truck, and I was I calmed down, I sat there, and I was like, all right, well, if I freak out, I'll die quicker. And then I was like, well, you know what, this has been a good summer. If I do die, all right, you know. I was very nonchalant about it. Then I got this big adrenaline rush, and I jumped again, and I, like, pivoted and locked in, and the guy running the hydraulics tapped my head with his hand, and I was like, all right, okay, he's able to reach me. And so I fell down again, and I jumped as hard as I could, and he grabbed my arm, and he pulled me up, and as I had said, they had to drop everything two, three more feet down, so we had like a ring around us, a rim, and he pulled me up, and I was standing on top of that, like all the way up on my feet, and he was like leaned over on my platform, like his feet on his platform and his chest on mine. And he pulled me up to standing 3 feet above him.
And then you decided, this isn't for me.
Yeah, kind of. Well, you know, actually, not that the job wasn't for me. It was just like, that
dying.
Was basically it. Dying, kind of.
That's
yeah, we kind of joked about it the whole way back, and it made it a lot less terrifying, and I was like, I didn't have nightmares.
And then you went in the house and changed your pants.
I actually went and had to go rinse off in the river that still had ice on it.
Yeah, from foaming agent.
Yeah, yeah, I looked like the swamp thing.
Biggest night of my life as far as being a designer is we had a Puma show at Studio 54.
Yeah, yeah.
And 90% of the work was my stuff. It was all, you know, all graphic designs and whatnot. And while we were there, the guys who had done the printing were coming up to me and the people that I work for and showing them new designs for the following year.
Wow. So using you as a platform to
No, actually, not as a platform. They were stepping on my head to do this. It was absolutely stunning. And I was freaking out. There I was in Studio 54. I was 34 years old or 35 years old. And I thought I'd made it. I said, wow, you can't get any further than this. And I had people just killing me that night in Studio 54, where they have the couches and all this. I had never been to Studio 54. I would never, ever have been in Studio 54 if it had not been for that night. And I had people trying just to crush my head.
Wow.
That says it all, doesn't it? That's an interesting bio, mate. You're a lawyer. You're a magician, and you're a recipient of being married in Grand Central Station. Fantastic.
I'm curious about the lifetime of furniture. Do they just like keep sending you stuff, or was it just a huge, like, massive truck of furniture?
Well, the lawyer in me required a contract. Originally, they just defined it as a lifetime supply of furniture, but I figured that that might at some point be a problem. So we have a contract. The three different phases of our lives, we were going to get our furniture. One was when we got married.
Mm-hmm.
The other was when we had our first child. Yeah. And then finally when I retire, which I, at that time, was hoping would be age 50, which is coming up this year.
And are you on track?
A few more years, I'll probably continue working.
Right.
But so we get another round of furniture actually this year, which is nice.
Excellent, yeah.
So what do you get to pick the furniture, or do they say, hey, we're giving you a couch, a bed, and a, you know, that's it.
It was $15,000 for each phase. Well, for two of the phases, one was, I think, $7,500. And then we had them adjusted for the consumer price index. So this round, since it's 20 years later, this round is going to be $23,000, I think.
Nice.
And the best part is, they have to deliver and assemble the furniture. We put that in the contract.
Wow. using their own little language-free diagrams to put this stuff together.
That's right. And what they didn't know, and we didn't know at the time, was that we were going to live in the Catskill Mountains. We were living in the Bronx at the time, which was no big deal. But now they have to come up here. And
well, I bet the guy's delivering a lot. It's a night out, you know. It's a day out, you know.
Yeah.
But that must be fascinating, getting married in Grand Central Station.
It was a whirlwind affair. It was 13 days notice. That's all we had. It was a contest.
So how did you find out about the contest, and how did you enter it?
My wife saw it in the Daily News.
Right.
And, well, at that point in our lives, there was a little pressure for me to make a commitment and get married, as many men know.
Yeah.
And she saw that, and I had to show some good faith. So I said, sure, why don't we enter the contest? The contest was, if you wrote you had to write an essay on why you were the ideal New York City couple.
Right.
And anybody was allowed to enter as long as they were willing to get married on 13 days' notice. So we wrote an essay, and we won.
Wow.
And how long was the essay?
It was a page. I think they gave us a limit, so it might have been a page.
250 words or something.
Right. I don't remember. I think it was like one page. But we had a lot of ties to New York City. Both our parents were immigrants. We both served the city of New York. We both were born in the city of New York, so that kind of, I think, allowed us to stand out a little bit.
Yeah, and did they know? I know we've talked off mic about some of your ancestors. Did they know about them at the time?
They did not.
I'm referring specifically to who am I referring to?
Well, my great grandfather was a mafia don in New York City, and my uncle was Joe Valachi.
Wow.
And my great grandfather was Gaetano Reina, R-E-I-N-A.
Right.
And not only did they not know, but when I got hired by the Bronx District Attorney's Office, it didn't come up in their investigation. I was very pleased because maybe I wouldn't have gotten the job.
And so right about that time, I met a guy who was a producer, and he said, "I'm taking the Jackson 5 to Africa. Would you please go help me?" And I was like, "You going to pay my expenses?" And he said, "Sure." And I had a passport. That was the first thing I did.
This has never happened to me. You know, somebody just walks up and says, "Hey, by the way, we're taking the Rolling Stones to Africa. I'm going to come there."
That's why I didn't believe him. Yeah. I thought, oh, yeah, right. I mean, I knew he was Senegalese, but, you know.
Right,
so, but
right, right.
As things, and I was, by then, I had moved on from CBS, and I was working for a magazine called Black Enterprise Magazine.
Right.
Earl Graves runs that magazine. It's a business magazine.
So how, you know, moving on to so did you meet all of the guys?
Oh,
in the
yeah, it was only the guys. It was, you know, the six boys and the dad.
Right.
And my job was to coordinate and make the press junkets happen and all of that. So a quick, funny story. I'm very allergic to shellfish, and I mean really allergic to shellfish. So we had a press conference at the Four Seasons here in New York. And I had a salad, but I didn't know there was clams in the salad because when shellfish is really good, you don't smell it. Mm. 20 minutes later, I was out like a light, and I remember Michael laughing and saying, "We have to get her out of here, she's falling out." So every time I would see him, he would, and I saw him a lot. We actually became quite close. When I was doing the Lena Horne show, he came to see the show 5 times.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yes, he loved Lena Horne. And so anyway, that was a wonderful experience for all of us because none of us had been to Africa before. And when they found out I was from Indiana, because they're from Gary, Indiana, and I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana. So that was like a big, you know, we just bonded. So it was a great experience.
Right.
Yeah.
So what countries did you go to in Africa?
We went to Senegal, and it's what cities within Senegal. We went to Saint-Louis, which was the original capital of Senegal, and we spent a lot of time in Dakar, and it was an amazing experience. He did these concerts in these soccer stadiums.
Sure.
And all these people, I had never been exposed to anything like that before in my life. And we came back to New York after the tour, and I got them to do my show Midday and Wonderama for Channel 5. And then I went to their concert at Madison Square Garden, which was insane. I had never seen that many people in my life. It was just crazy. So that was a great experience. And then I knew I was on the way to what I wanted to do for a living.
You know, a lot of the time in every facet of entertainment and other things in life, it's about who you know and what you know. And it's not necessarily about what's good and what's not good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've heard songs in the past, and I'm sure you have, and, you know, met people with ideas, and they don't go anywhere because they don't know the key people that open doors. I really do hope these doors open for you.
Can be, you know, right place, right time.
Yeah.
You know, we had a guest that was hanging out at an establishment in New York City. Somebody comes up, "Hey, you want a tour in Africa?" And wham, bam.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
With the Jacksons, I have to say. Which was... strange, you know, she was telling us a story. Yeah, I just went to New York City, end up working a tour with the Jacksons.
Yeah.
And we're like, wait a minute. That just doesn't happen, does it?
You know, it's a luck does play a major role in this.
Yeah.
If you talk to most Hollywood stars, they'll tell you about another actor who was in one of their acting classes that everyone thought was going to be extremely successful and never did it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's... You know, it's very common, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's sad. As you know, sometimes there's, you know, for every multi-talented actor on the television, there's probably 150 behind them could do slightly better.
Well, if there's anyone out there in the radio audience that would like to help out, I'm absolutely. I really do think we're sitting on, of the 9 musicals I have, I think 5 could go to Broadway.
Well, good luck with you.
Thank you.
Now, you were talking about the Broadway. What was the one the one I have right next to me, actually?
That's Middle School Madness.
Middle School Madness.
The musical. And we actually have a poster right here.
Yeah, I've got this poster. Cue sound effects.
From one.
I have the poster in my hand, signed, I assume, by the people who were in the...
Well, so far, there have been a total of 40 performances in 13 cities... with 8 different casts.
Right.
We've done this with as few as 7 kids. And in Portugal, they did it with over 109. And it was
wow.
Just... So it's an extremely flexible show that can be adjusted to the schools and to the cast members. For example, There's a song called Tall. And when we did the original show, it was sung by a short boy who wished he was tall as a solo.
Well, what I was going to say to you, James, is can you give us a premise of the show?
Yeah. Middle School Madness essentially is a musical documentary of the middle school experience.
Right.
It's not a kid's show, but it's a show about the middle schooler. It's in all of us.
Right.
And it'll take parents right back to what it was like. Grandparents love it. The middle school experience has not changed inside these kids. Yeah, a lot of the details have changed, but it's still they're middle schoolers. And just like we were in junior high.
My mind goes, just now, my mind is going to that program it was on in the 80s. I think it was the 80s or early 90s.
The Wonder Years. Fred Savage.
And that was such a successful show because I think, as you say, it took everybody back there, didn't it? And it didn't matter if it was the 60s, 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
You still went back to that time and you could relate as a kid.
Yes. Well, exactly. I mean, I remember when I was 11 years old, I was 4'7". 12, 4'9", 13, 4'11". Why do I remember these things? Because I wanted to be tall.
Yes.
And so that was how the song started. A short boy wished he was tall. Then in a subsequent cast, we had a very tall girl. And so I rewrote it as a duet between a short boy who wished he was tall and a tall girl who wishes she was short.
Nice.
Excellent.
And it's just, and then the last show we did, we didn't have a tall girl in the cast, but we had two short boys who were best buddies, and so we did it as a duet.
Yeah.
And, you know, it works every time because it's true. And it connects with kids. And they really hop on the music like you wouldn't believe.
And is this a comedy or is it a mixture of comedy and poignancy? Or?
Yes.
Right.
It's a comedy and poignancy. To me, that's part of my writing.
Right.
You can't just have all comedy because there's got to be a human element.
So, Thomas, tell us about this community soccer coaching for your beloved Celtic. How did that come about?
Well, first I'll tell you a story. I remember when I was a five-year-old, six-year-old boy playing soccer in school, and I was pretty good. I'd say I was one of the best in my class at that age.
No laughing at the back there. Sorry.
I was one of the youngest to play for the school team. I was in primary three, and I got chose to play left back, position on the park, that is. I was pretty good. And I said to myself, I'm going to sign for Celtic. On my 16th birthday, I'm going to just go up to Celtic Park and sign for Celtic. That was it. I was naive, obviously. But obviously, it never happened. My football career didn't go the way I wanted it to go. So, and I eventually got the interview for Celtic to go and sign for them as a coach. It was on my 26th birthday. And I was in one of the director's boxes getting my interview, and I signed the contract looking out onto the pitch. So, yeah. I finally got to do it. But 10 years later, I finally got to do it. So it came about my older brother, Brian, our older brother, Brian. He kind of got me involved in coaching. I went and obtained my badges through the SFA, Scottish Football Association, and became a coach in the local area in Glasgow, working for two local authorities, subsequently Celtic. And it was working in the area in Glasgow, different groups, vulnerable groups, ranging from the ages of 5 to 16. It was great, loved it. The only thing was, it was, you didn't have a set schedule where you were working. One week you'd be working with one group of kids, the next week you'd be working with a different group of kids, so it wasn't consistent, so you couldn't really kind of build up a rapport with the kids, because changing all the time.
So you got to be employed by the club that you loved.
Yeah.
And that says something, doesn't it?
It does.
It kind of partially lives a dream. Did you manage to run out in Celtic Park?
No. But I did get free Celtic jerseys and Celtic shorts and t-shirts and shoes and stuff.
Now, Thomas, I have a question for you. you didn't have the opportunity to play for Celtic, but what if another team had recruited you? Say, I don't know, maybe the Rangers or something like that. Would you have signed on the dotted line then?
Andy, give him a slap.
I think it's fair to say that...
The answer would be no.
Wow. Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that any self-respecting Celtic fan would never entertain the mere notion of signing for the Rangers. Rangers died, essentially, about 2 or 3 years ago. And no matter who tries to kid themselves on, the club went into receivership and subsequently the company died.
Do you ever go backpacking or camping anymore?
Last August I went camping out near the Pennsylvania border, right on the Delaware River. It was a campsite, but I got my own tent, mm-hmm. you know, my own little setup, and I haven't had much opportunity, but...
Campsite.
Yeah. I mean, I had a tent, so it was kind of camping, but, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to do that out here. But I've definitely built a lot of campfires and showed off some skills. And
did you use your cotton wool and your...
My
petroleum jelly cotton buds to keep the fire going?
No, I did build a fire with a magnesium rod like flint and steel.
Ooh,
just
yeah,
to show
oh,
off.
Yeah. Nice.
But it takes a long time because you just got to sit and scrape.
Yeah, all those shavings. Yeah. But once you get it with a spark, right, it's like 3,000 degrees. And
yeah, just...
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then you look like a, you know, BA. Everybody's like, whoa, this guy...
Some sort of
just so happens you're only there yourself.
Exactly.
Like, you're like, if anybody had been here, I would have looked like a BA.
Right? Like, gosh,
but I'm not.
Crowd?
I'm on my own.
The little woodland creatures have gathered around and they golf clap. They're like, oh, brilliant. Well done, sir. Brilliant.
Yes.
The technique is amazing.
The local woodland creatures.
Yeah. I actually got one signed by one of my idols.
Yeah, who was that?
It was Chris Vidala. He's actually from Poughkeepsie, New York. He plays with Chuck Mangione.
Oh, right.
I saw him in Rome. Huge mistake. I brought a dry erase marker instead of a Sharpie and didn't know it.
Oh, no.
So I went up, got his autograph, and then an hour later it was gone.
Oh, no.
He was my idol, too, so.
Well, at least you got it. Oh,
yeah.
Have you still got the album?
You know, I don't know where it is. It was my mom's album from back in the day.
Right.
And I don't know where it is anymore.
Well, you still get the memory.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
yeah. You still get them. You've met him. Was he good? Was he kind to you? And
oh,
was
yeah.
he pleasant
yeah.
and stuff?
I've met both him and Chuck Mangione. Yeah, I've seen them in different shows.
Right. I mean, there's one of the. I know we're going to speak about Chuck Mangione in a little bit. But what I was going to say there is, I've got a fear of meeting people that are, you know, that I really really like, and you know, I would love to meet Willie Nelson or something like that. And I'm scared in case he's ignorant and too tired to talk to me, and it really upsets me, you know, and my image of him goes down, you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of steered away from even being in that situation if I had the chance.
I was in Lake Placid, and I was a huge, 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 huge Rangers fan growing up. And
can we just clarify, you know, in Glasgow, the Rangers are a soccer team. They are the biggest rivals of my team, Celtic. The New York Rangers. Thank you. My family would never have allowed me to for you to sit here and not clarify that.
In 1994, when they won the Cup, we watched every game, and Mike Richter was the goalie.
Right.
And I was sitting in Lake Placid, and I was sitting on a bench, and he came out of an elevator right in front of me, and I was just dumbstruck. I didn't know what to do. I'm like, oh my God, that's Mike Richter. And he just walked away. And I thought, oh my God, I missed the chance of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I looked for him all day in Lake Placid. I'm at the same spot at the end of the day waiting for the rest of the family. And he walks back up the corridor. And this time I'm like, I'm not letting this one pass. So I got to meet Mike Richter.
What did you say to him?
I said, I watched every game in 94. I'm a huge fan. And he said, I hope you didn't watch after that.
And so he's pleasant to you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I remember I was at a friend's child's christening, and we had it in this golf reception was in a golf club, and one of my idols, the legendary Billy McNeil, who was the first man of the Celtic team and the first man in Britain to lift the European Cup.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And he was walking to the door to let us in, having played a game of golf. And he looked at all of the guys in the group were just dumbstruck like you, yeah. you know. Mm-hmm. And we're all standing there. And he said, "Are you Rangers fans?" And we were like, "No, no, no." And he went, "Yeah, I realised that, because you're all good looking."
I started fly fishing about 6 years ago. Something I always wanted to do. I love fishing. Used to go a lot with my mates and when I was in Scotland. Used to go camping, do some bait fishing. But my mate, my friend Pete, he's a really accomplished fly fisherman, and he taught me how to fly fish. And since then, it's kind of the only fishing I'll do. So yeah, especially it's great when you've got time yourself, you know, to go and do some fly fishing, and it's relaxing.
And you're fishing for trout when you fly fish?
Yeah, trout predominantly. I'd like to start fishing for salmon, but I need to change my rods and stuff like that for that, so it's going to take me a bit of money.
Salmon are a little bit bigger, right?
Salmon are bigger. The rods are bigger as well.
Unless you caught the record trout in 118 years, coming in at 24 pounds.
Wow.
Which is 11, it was 11.8 kilos. Is that how you say it in Scotland, kilos?
Yeah.
11.8 kilos.
Where was it caught?
I don't remember.
No?
I couldn't pronounce it. It was off the coast of something and in a river. And
Thomas sent me a picture of a trout he caught. It must have been about, how many pounds was that big trout you caught? I'll show you when we finish.
12.5 pounds, that was.
Wow, it was a big fish anyway.
You ever eat them, Thomas?
Sorry?
You ever catch them and eat them? Fry them up?
Yeah, I wouldn't catch them, and I don't like throwing them back. I don't see the point of fishing and throwing the fish back.
No. But what if you catch a small one, though?
Well, it's good for a small sandwich.
Now, in certain parts of Scotland, they don't call trout. They call them trout.
Trout.
So I remember going fishing with Thomas and his mate. Actually, Thomas's mate, Big Pete.
Down the earth guy, by the way.
Yeah, down the earth guy, yeah. He was, his uncle did play for Celtic. He's a famous Celtic player.
Wow.
Roy Aitken. But we went camping, and every time he spoke about the fish, he was calling them trout. Trout.
And you're like, and I just found trout.
That, yeah, I found that funny. I was like, it's trout. Trout. He stays down in the Ayrshire coast. Mm.
Thomas, do you tie your own flies and make your own bait?
I've attempted to tie some flies, but I've never caught a fish on any of them, so I've kind of retired them.
Sure.
Unsuccessful. To be honest with you, I'm not getting a lot of time to fly fish at the moment, due to having a family and and school and stuff. So
sounds like you could use a Catskill Cabin weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could actually.
And maybe you can catch some trout.
Maybe.
And
just don't use your own flies.
No.
The one that sticks out for me is the fox mid jump.
Oh, the four fox. I did a composite photo of four foxes. I've been watching foxes, and this is a panoramic photo, 12 by 36. And what I did is I took a fox in the Lamora Valley who is hunting for probably mice or voles. And he's listening. He's setting up. He jumps, and all of a sudden, all you see is his butt sticking out of the out of the snow, where he gets his meal,
his reward, his prize,
his reward. And my wife Amelia kept saying, "Why don't you just do a composite of this?" And I worked as a professional artist all my life, and I worked Photoshop, Illustrator. And I did not want to do anything other than photography. I just want, because back when I was in the service, and as a kid, in high school, I did photography. I was black and white for 20 years. All I did was black and white. And then I started doing digital photography, and I didn't want to be a digital artist with this.
So but you just wanted to keep it raw and pure.
Yes, because that's what I always had done. And Amelia always wanted me to do something with these foxes. So I had my first solo show at Catskill Fine Arts in Hunter. And they gave me the number of shots I should have. And then they moved some furniture or something around. You need 4 more shots. And Amelia goes, do the foxes.
That was easy.
So I did. Because I used to just wail away. I'd take 30 or 40 shots of this fox. And I can't tell you how many foxes I've seen do this. But I had one particular really good one at a place called Hitching Post in the Lamar Valley. So I went home and I did it. And it's probably one of the most iconic photographs I've ever done, because it's been, I've actually won a lot of awards with it. And it's been, I've sold it probably more than anything that I've ever done.
How satisfying is it to win an award?
It's okay.
For something that you've created, though.
You know? You want to know something? I don't know why, but it's just okay. I don't care. It's doing the photography is what it's about. I think it sounds a little bit stupid, but it's just about doing the photography. Winning the awards is... I've won a bunch of awards, mostly online stuff. And it just doesn't, you know, if it's online, does it mean anything?
Well, you know, it's the way we're moving forward. So forever, you know, for a lot of people who are younger than us, and we are getting up there, Larry. it's everything.
They bought, and I had that guitar that they bought me for, I still have that guitar, but the neck is starting to bend out on it.
You've got a neck issue, haven't you?
I know, and I have a personal neck issue too, like my own neck.
Yeah.
Forget guitar necks, my own neck is always like...
Maybe a metaphor for something, the neck issue.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know, I'm not a spiritualist, I don't know.
I actually bought a new one recently, and it was only $100, and it was from this company called R.W. Jameson, and they specialize in thin line guitars, so the actual guitar, is way thinner than usual, which makes it easy for me because I have like these small like raptor arms that have always made it difficult, and so I like can play it so much easier and
excellent,
and it's beautiful, and it's an acoustic electric, so it's a plug-in, and so and it's like one of the best guitars I've ever owned, and it's just $100 guitar, so I mean,
nice.
You know, my friend George, who's been on our show, and he actually played the guitar on his guitar on the show. It was a Yamaha, wasn't it, Mike?
Yes.
Yep. And it's, like you, it's a trusted guitar. He's had this guitar. It's been everywhere with him. You know, it's probably, if the guitar could talk, it would have, you know, some stories to tell. But for his 40th birthday, we all chipped in money, and we bought him a silent guitar. You know, and I'd never heard of this thing. And basically, you plug it in, and you plug in headphones, and you can sit in the house and play it, but nobody can hear the guitar being played. Nice. So you're not interrupting people watching the TV or, you know, in a small house or something, you know?
Yep.
And I thought that was quite ingenious.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure he still got it, because George keeps things like that, but... and he'll do his best to make sure it's still in pristine condition, and I'm sure he still uses it, you know, but fantastic instrument.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, technology comes a long way.
So would you write some songs if you were in the cabin, or would you just play some songs?
Yeah? I would probably like try my best at writing. Like I've written a bunch of songs like over time. None of them I don't know if are very good or not, but But if I play them, people sometimes like them. So it's okay. Nice. But if I were alone in a cabin, like, I'm sure something would come over me to write a little ditty or a little jam.
Yeah, you'd be inspired by the...
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I write songs about things that are less important than being alone in nature. So, like, stupid things, you know?
Now, come back to the horror movies. If you were in the cabin on your own, would you start letting your mind wander and go...
What was that noise?
What was that noise? And there's like, I'm sure there's zombies outside and...
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. Like, if I were in a cabin in the middle of the woods alone at night, 100%. Which is weird, because if I was in a tent alone in the middle of the night in the woods, I wouldn't actually think that.
I'm the opposite. Yeah. I'm, you know, the house I've got in the mountains, you know, it's... Mike's been in there scores of times. And, you know, if you're in there on your own at night... Mm-hmm. Then you hear all different things, you know, coyotes, owls, you know, and that doesn't bother me a jot. But I went camping with Mike, and he had his tent, and I had my tent in Orlando, and I'm thinking to myself, what if a bear comes over here and just, like, mauls me in this tent?
Andy, what's... keep it down, I'm trying to sleep.
So I'm the opposite.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I feel like most people either are inclined to one over the other. I mean, cabins in the woods are beautiful. I actually spend a week every summer with my wife's family in Minnesota at this lake cabin resort, which is beautiful. Ooh. But you're not exactly alone. I mean, the whole family, like the extended family, goes, and it's always like a really fun time. But there, I mean, maybe because there's so many cabins around and so many people, you always feel like super protected and safe. But I do love cabins. But I mean, yeah, I would absolutely just like hear noises. I would like that coyote that you heard, I would kidnap that for protection.
You know? Come here, little boy.
Can I interest you in a squirrel?
Nah, I've got you. Ha ha.
Actually, I'd have to back up a little bit and say that at first my wife had bought me a book on card magic, and I had gotten sick after we came back from Italy. And that book had sat there for a couple of years, but when I got sick, when we came home, I picked it up and started looking at it.
Right.
And I started doing card tricks. But I think it was really when I went to Scotland in the UK that I fell in love with street performing.
Right.
As an art form.
We did a show a while ago, and I was with Patricia Charbonneau,
yes.
And I was talking about busking in Scotland. It was Neil Young who was a YouTube video of Neil Young busking in Glasgow the day of his concert that night, and nobody knew, you know, very few people knew who he was sitting in the street, and Mike didn't know what
busking means.
Familiar with the phrase busking, but busking is major in Europe, isn't it?
It really is, and unfortunately it's not here in the U.S., but it's an art form that's very well respected in the U.K.
Yeah.
And in Europe in general. Mm-hmm. And there are performers that dedicate their career to busking.
Yes.
And that's wonderful to see.
Yeah. Now, do you perform?
Yes.
And perform regularly as...
I do, yeah. I just performed this past Saturday, and I have a gig coming this Saturday.
Right, okay. And how long does that last? Is it like an hour or so? Or?
It depends. If it's a party, it's usually about an hour. But if it's strolling magic, then maybe longer. I have a regular gig at the Chicken Run Restaurant in Wyndham. And I'll perform there most Saturday nights when I'm not performing somewhere else.
Now, you said... Is
roaming.
Is that just walking about the people?
Yes, approach people while they're eating their dinner, while they're waiting for their meal, or if they're finished with their meal and they're waiting for the check.
Yeah, I've seen that before. That's excellent. So I think it intrigues people and it keeps people entertained, and you know.
And the owners like it because if they're waiting for their food comes quicker.
Yeah. Right?
And if they're finished with their food, they tend to stay longer.
Yeah.
And
get another drink, get a dessert.
Exactly. And it just enhances their experience overall.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win.
Excellent. You say your father's from Scotland?
Yes.
Whereabouts in Scotland?
Shotts.
Shotts? Shotts is just outside of Glasgow.
Correct.
It's on the periphery of Glasgow. It's almost like if you imagine, say, New York City, and it's kind of like Westchester, a kind of borough of greater Glasgow. And how, did he move here, or is he...?
He did. He came here at age 17.
Right.
He was the youngest of 13. Right. And he was the only one that came to America.
And did he maintain his accent?
Only when he was mad.
So then I worked on this I came back to New York after the earthquake in L.A. That's actually why I left L.A., because in 1994 they had this massive... Mm. They said 6.9. I know it was 7.1 because I was there. Earthquake. And I thought, okay, I'm listening. I'm not staying out here. So
sure.
I came back to New York to do Jackie Mason's show. And I met this young man at a party here in New Paltz. I mean, I had never been to New Paltz. The Hudson Valley is like this magical place for me. And I've been all over the world. This is where I want to be, right here in the Hudson Valley. It's just magical. And so I met Jack Butler, we were at a Christmas party. Actually, it was a Boxing Day party. You know, Boxing Day is the day after Christmas.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a Canadian holiday.
It's actually a British
is
holiday.
It?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And kind of you know, given to the Canadians by the British.
Oh, okay. You know, so that's how we got there.
The Commonwealth.
Gotcha.
So, but yes.
It was a great party. And so there was this guy, and he had these twinkly eyes, and he was talking about having lived in Nairobi, and that his quote-unquote roommate, that, you know, because in Nairobi, you do all your business at your watering hole. Your local watering hole.
Mm-hmm.
So Barack Obama Sr. was his stablemate, so to speak, because they had both gone to Harvard. My husband had an MBA from Harvard, and Barack Obama's dad went to Harvard as well. So, right. And then his first investors were Jim Brown, the football player, and James Brown, the singer, had a company, and they invested in Africa. So they invested in my husband. And he built the first ever townhomes in Nairobi called Kiambere, and they're still existing. People, it's a destination for middle-class families.
Mm.
And this is a very New Paltz story. My husband's other sort of stablemate was this guy named Abdullahi, Haji Abdullahi. And Haji had gone to Vassar. So when he met Jack and they really hit it off and... He said, oh, your last name is Butler. Do you know Dr. Marjorie Butler? And Jack said, that's my mother. How do you know my mother? Well, my mother-in-law, who used to live right next door, my mother-in-law taught at Vassar, and Haji was in that first class when it went from, you know, only female to co-ed. And mm-hmm. Haji was in that group, and
right.
That's how he met
right.
Mom before he met Jack.
Ah.
Isn't that interesting?
Very cool. Interesting.
So that's my connection to the apples in the Hudson Valley, because there's nothing like the apples that are grown here in the Hudson Valley. So if I'm going to be in a Catskill cabin, I want my apples, my popcorn, and my globe, and my photo album.
No, I have some facts here.
Okay.
It takes 10 years mm-hmm. for a tree, once it's planted, to grow it and to bear fruit. Did you know that?
I did not
apple
know
tree.
That.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
What?
And do you know how many apples it takes to make 1 gallon of salad?
No.
Salad. Cider. Take a guess.
2 bushels.
What's a bushel? I've heard of a bushel.
It's one of those obscure, arbitrary American
yeah, like 36 apples in a basket.
36 apples.
36 apples, okay.
See? That is a bushel.
Is it?
Right. Yes.
Wow. Hey.
I wasn't
wow.
making that up.
Wow.
Sounds like bushel to me. How many pounds of apples make a 9-inch pie?
Oh, God. Pounds? Wow.
Yes.
I don't know.
3?
I don't know. I'll go with 3.
2.
2 pounds.
2 pounds of apples.
He likes apples.
I like a thicker apple pie.
Me
so,
too. Me too.
So
And apples are, they ripen or soften 10 times faster at room temperature than if they were refrigerated.
That I know. That's why I put them in the refrigerator, so I can make them last.
Just thought I'd throw out some little bits of trivia.
The Hudson Valley grows the best apples ever. I'm just saying.
So what's your favorite apple?
Honeycrisp.
Yes.
Honeycrisp.
Mine too.
Yes.
What one's that?
It's
got a crunch.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a pink color, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like a rose kind of hue.
Mm-hmm. And it's meaty, it's solid.
Yes. My favorite is the Macintosh.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Macs are good. But you can get Macs anywhere. You can only get Honeycrisps in the Hudson Valley.
Is that right?
I don't know. You don't get them in Indianapolis. Because I grew up next to we lived in the middle of a cherry orchard and an apple orchard. And the apples were Macs. And the cherries were those little red cherries, not the big dark bean cherries, but little sour cherries, I think they call them.
Right.
Mm.
But the moment I tasted a Honeycrisp, I thought, this is it.
This is amazing.
This is an amazing apple.
My grandpa grew up on an orchard, an apple orchard near Lake Ontario, and he later got into, he went on and started his own business, but he got into grafting different breeds of apple branches onto trees. So I'd go over to his house and you'd have a tree with like three different types of apples on it. And that was a lot
that
of fun.
That is cool, because there was a guy.
For me, it was a place to relax. The strangest place I've seen a hammock used was on a submarine in Buffalo. We got to tour one of the old submarines in Buffalo, and they actually had torpedoes stacked three high and three across, so a matrix of like nine torpedoes. And they strung hammocks in between the torpedoes, and that's where the guys slept.
Wow.
Yikes. So, you know, I use mine to relax in the woods, and these guys are sleeping on them, surrounded by torpedoes.
Gives a new meaning to, you know, hey, Joe, did you fart there, or was that something else? You know, was that part of my dream? I don't know. But sleeping amongst the bombs is not something I'd want to do, you know?
Not very relaxing. No.
Thomas, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen The Big Lebowski?
Tell me about this Big Lebowski.
It's one of the greatest movies of all time, written and directed by the Coen brothers.
Shut up, Mike.
I'm stealing all Andy's stuff.
Mike, you don't need to tell me. I'm seated in The Big Lebowski.
Nice.
One day I saw Thomas. It was either pictures or I saw him physically dressed up as the Big Lebowski, standing holding Folgers can.
As the dude.
Yes.
The dude, yeah.
Actually, that's what he calls himself, the dude.
Yeah.
Now, you're a musician.
I am. 2 years ago, I started to get into magic.
Right. Now, I know Mike forgot his computer, and while he was away, you were doing a couple of tricks on me, and it amazes me how the sleight of hand is, you know, right in front of your face and you still can't see it. Obviously, that's the hallmark of a good magician, but I was amazed. You know, I don't want to give the game away, obviously, but it was fascinating to me.
Hmm.
Maybe when we're finished here, you can do a couple on mic.
Sure. Yeah. It's one of those art forms where we put a lot of time in so that you don't see what we're doing.
Right. Hmm. And how long does it, you have to practice and practice and practice?
I practice every day.
You do?
Yes. Right. Yeah, several hours a day, and you just would never become good at it if you didn't.
Right.
What made you want to get into magic?
I was actually went to Scotland for a wedding, and
where's that?
Now, Brian, another item, the last item you'd like to bring is a road bike. Bikes became popular in the mid 19th century, and I thought it would be older than that, but they're really kind of a new thing. There have been twice as many bikes produced as automobiles. And the bicycle, the modern bicycle, is an advancement of what was called the velocipede. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, the old-timey big wheel in the front, small wheel in the back style things. That was a velocipede. And
what was the other one? The penny farthing.
No, what is that?
The penny farthing was the British version, I think. You know, the penny, obviously, the farthing is a part of the old coin system in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
It's the big ginormous wheel.
Huh.
Mm. Remember the, you know, have you ever seen that picture? The big giant wheel and then the tiny wheel at the back.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that's the same one you're talking about.
Yeah, same idea.
Yeah, it's called the penny farthing in Britain.
Oh, okay. And originally bikes were, I think, kind of like Fred Flintstone style leg propelled, but apparently, possibly, the first mechanically propelled two-wheeled vehicle may have been built by a gentleman, Kirkpatrick Macmillan, a Scottish blacksmith.
So I see, that sounds a Scottish name, doesn't it?
In 1839, although that's been disputed. He is also associated, and I find this appropriate, Andy,
with the first recorded instance of a cycling traffic offense. When Glasgow newspaper in 1842 reported an accident in which an anonymous gentleman from Dumfriesshire bestride a velocipede of ingenious design, knocked over a little girl in Glasgow, and was fined 5 shillings. Step aside!
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Probably
a little hard to control that big wheel.
Yes, yeah. These pesky Glaswegians, you know. They're just anger-driven.
And lastly...
Well, hold on. Talking of speed and aggression, do you know how fast the fastest bike has ever been went and it's been recorded at?
No.
Take a guess.
Oh, God. I'd say 100 miles an hour.
I was going to say the same.
Well, take a guess.
101.
167 miles an hour.
Jeez.
You can imagine crashing at that speed.
No.
I actually crashed one time. I T-boned a car. I was going about 20 miles an hour, and I hit the car right in the hubcap, and I flipped over the back of the car, over the trunk, and landed on my back on the other side of the car on the road.
Wow.
And I landed on my back, and my feet were still clipped in. I was still holding the handlebars, but I'm laying on my back, and I'm looking up, and I was still at
the bike's on top of you.
Reading it, yeah. Riding it, yeah. Your feet stay in those things.
Now, Unc, your next item is a bicycle.
The first time I had it, we were actually on camping in the Thousand Islands, and my son and his girlfriend were walking toward me by the bathhouse, and I was just coming back for a ride. Mm-hmm. And I slowed down, forgetting I was clipped in. Until the last minute when you'd normally put your feet down to catch yourself.
Oh.
Well, trust me, you cannot get your feet out fast enough to catch yourself.
Oh, no.
So they had a very good laugh at my expense. Laying on the ground right there in front of them. It was, if you remember laughing, it was like the guy on the bicycle, on the tricycle, just come up and over he went. I'm sure that's what I looked like.
It was at an intersection, kind of. So there were people stopped at the red light, and they saw me do this. And they came running over, and they're like, "You are so lucky to be alive," because I landed, I guess, on my head.
Yikes.
But I didn't even know it. I laid there literally on my back with the bike in the air thinking the pain is going to start immediately, you know, and I didn't feel a thing. I had a scratch in my elbow. That was it. But when I looked at my helmet, it was shattered in the back, so I did land on my head.
Wow. Thank God.
Those helmets do work. Absolutely.
Speaks to helmets.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was 45 miles into a 65-mile ride.
That's impressive to begin with.
Yeah.
And I was 19.8 miles an hour for an average, and I was trying to get 20 miles an hour. And I was going up this long grade, and I saw something in my front sprocket going around. I was like, oh, do I need to stop or can I keep going? And next thing I know, I looked down again and I got my answer. I went off the side of the road.
Oh, no.
The sad thing is it was a brand new paved road, and it was like 8 foot wide shoulder, and I went off the edge of it. Just because I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
And I know I was going 24 miles an hour. That's why I was trying to get that 20 mile an hour average.
Mm.
And so 24 miles an hour hit the pavement, and I did a pretty good job on myself.
Yeah.
But I did finish the other 20 miles and I made it home, but I lost a mile an hour.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
As long as you were alive, yeah. You know.
I'm not complaining at all.
That's okay.
I was pretty scraped up, but...
They should create some sort of airbag system in those really tight spandex outfits so that if you're falling, it sends in and you just burn.
Better give someone like me just a little bit more intelligence so you don't do it in the first place.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, that's so handy.
Those are some of our favorite moments from last year. Both of us are looking forward to 2016 and the fun we will have getting to know our future guests that little bit better. We would like to thank you for listening throughout the past year, and to end our show, we would like to reflect on some of our guests' responses to our trademark question.
How do you take your coffee?
Oh, that's a tuple with cream.
Just a little cream and decaf, usually.
We don't need a thesis here, just go on with it.
All right then, so it would be double espresso with a small amount of hot milk.
And
one sugar.
Cream and sweeten low.
And why sweet and low?
Well, I figure if I ever get eaten by cannibals, I hope they die of cancer.
Excellent reasoning. Thank you.
I don't drink coffee.
I don't drink coffee.
With vanilla.
Okay.
If it's drip coffee, I drink it black. Maybe a little milk if I need to drink it faster. If it's an espresso beverage, my preferred is a cortado.
I don't know what any of that meant, but it sounded really good.
I don't drink coffee.
But if you did.
If I do, if I do drink it, like, and that's if I'm in need of caffeine rush, I take it black.
Black like my men.
Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter. And you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations.
Special thanks to George, Gordon and Billy from the band White for the theme music, and everybody at WGXE Acre. Thanks.
Merry Christmas and have a Happy New Year.